From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment Arts Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or ask your smart speaker to play SDPB. And you can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to our In the Moment Segments podcast. Now here's your weekly roundup in arts coverage. The coronavirus pandemic caused the cancellation of most cultural activities in South Dakota, including the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra performances. It's also put a halt or drastically altered many Lenten programs and services for Christians. Maestro Delta David Geyer and Pastor Mark Bertrand of Grace Presbyterian Church wanted to be of service to listeners who might be missing music as art and music as worship. They created a four-part series exploring musical masterpieces and the meaning behind them. So without further ado, here's part one of Hearing Music.
So just imagine that you're walking into the church, you sit down, and the first thing you hear is this.
Welcome to Hearing the Music, a show where we explore musical masterpieces and the meaning behind them. The music you're hearing is the opening chorale of Johann Sebastian Bach's St. John Passion, a classical masterwork. Over the course of the next four episodes, we will be digging into the St. John Passion. The voice you heard at the beginning was Delta David Geyer, the music director of the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra. He conducted the 2014 performance you're hearing, and will be our guide to the music. I'm Mark Bertrand. I'm a novelist and a Christian minister, the pastor of Grace Presbyterian Church in Sioux Falls. My job is to unpack some of the ideas of the gospel narrative that Bach set to music. Along the way, David and I will get a little help from the experts. For these episodes, we spoke with Dr. James Johnson, SDSO's chorus master, who has an incredible knowledge of the St. John Passion.
Bach always wanted to take his texts from the Bible itself, and using Bach's Passion libretto was not something that he would have found good to do, especially in a service setting.
We also spoke with Bach scholar Marcel Zitzer in the Netherlands.
We first of all find out that Bach was someone who studied the Bible very carefully and must have put quite an amount of time in it.
This is episode one, Arrest and Betrayal. David, why don't you tell us a little bit about the St. John Passion?
Well, I think it would behoove us to begin with just defining what a passion is, right? So it's the story of Jesus' arrest and trial, crucifixion, yeah?
And as the name of this one suggests, the St. John Passion, the text that Bach sets to music is the text from John's Gospel, chapters 18 and 19. And he actually uses the very text that you would find in Scripture, although the text he uses is from Martin Luther's German Bible, not an English translation.
Right. The whole thing's in German, that's for sure, because it was actually intended for liturgical use. So you would have gone to church on Good Friday, and this is what you would have heard. And it was a pivotal moment. We're talking about 1724 when Bach wrote this particular piece, and it was his first setting of a passion. And just recently, just 3 years before in 1721, Johann Kuhnau had presented a passion in Leipzig that sort of set the stage for this event, this Vespers service on Good Friday, becoming the liturgical event of the year. And Bach, not in an opportunistic way, but rather just saw the opportunity to seize the moment to create, to expand the form and to create something more substantial, more meaningful.
So looking at the structure of this piece, it's divided into two parts. And the first part is quite a bit shorter than the second part. And my understanding is during that Good Friday service, part one would have been performed. And then in the break between the two, a pastor would have gotten up and delivered a sermon.
Correct.
I can't imagine, as a pastor, being the one who would stand up and preach a sermon after hearing this music. But it's a good reminder, though, that this music was originally created as an act of worship to further the experience of that Good Friday worship service. And it is still possible for us, in listening to it, not only to listen to it as a beautiful aesthetic work of art, but also to experience it as devotional music.
Yeah, we go a step further and say that even if you're not looking at it personally as devotional music, that your experience of the piece of music is enhanced by understanding how it would have been used devotionally and what the intent was.
Right, right. So set the stage for us. I'm in Leipzig, it's Good Friday, I'm going to church. What would that experience have been like?
Well, it's rather mind-blowing, actually, if you think about it from our 21st century perspective, because our world is so filled with music everywhere. It's ubiquitous, and it's usually trying to sell us something, right? Or at least sell itself, which was not something that happened 300 years ago. And so chances are, when you went to church on Good Friday in Leipzig in 1724, that you would not have heard any music the entire week. And since you'd gone to church the previous Sunday, unless you made it yourself, it simply was not available. Maybe if you went to a beer hall, there'd be some singing or something. But, you know, so when I imagine how fresh upon the ear this music would have come to someone whose world was largely silent musically, it's the impact must have been very profound and meaningful for them. So just imagine that you're walking into the church, you sit down, and the first thing you hear is this. So, Mark, I hear so much anxiety in this music. You have a throbbing bass line. You have these achingly arching oboes in duet above it. And then you have a chorus, you know, crying out, Lord, oh, Lord, Herr, unser Herr. And to me, personally, this speaks of our anxiety to know, to have the assurance that God is in control. And it speaks today just as it did 300 years ago.
Now, I think you're right. You can hear that sort of throbbing anxiety, almost a panicky energy to the music, which is strange at first when you consider the words that they're speaking. This is a prayer, an invocation, where they are speaking to God and asking God to essentially reveal himself. In the English translation, it says, "Show us through your passion that you, the true Son of God, through all time, even in the greatest humiliation, have become transfigured." So they're asking to see the glory of God, but of course, against the backdrop of the crucifixion. The anxiety, I think, is produced by the idea that here Jesus is being killed, he's being crucified. The one who came to save us, seemingly, is being defeated by these unjust forces. And so that raises a huge question. It's a question in John's gospel, but it's a question for us forever after, having to do with whether or not God is in control, whether or not his promises will be kept. And in the narrative, the answer overwhelmingly, again and again, is yes. But the panic is real, the anxiety is real, and so it has to be addressed with great power.
So now we have the opening section of the narrative itself from the gospel. We are introduced to the character of the evangelist. In this case, it would be St. John himself telling the story of Jesus' arrest. And we will also have you'll hear interjections from the chorus, here playing the role of the soldiers coming to arrest Jesus. You'll also hear the voice of Jesus himself.
When Jesus asks the soldiers who they have come for, the chorus will respond, "Jesus of Nazareth." When he answers, "I am he," their reaction is astonishing. They fall to the ground. They draw back from him in awe. And this is a demonstration of his power. Even in the moment of his arrest, they cannot take him into their control unless he willingly submits to it.
Jesus ging mit seinen Jüngern über den Bach Kidron. Da war ein Garten, darein ging Jesus und seine Jünger. Judas aber, der ihn verriet, wusste den Ort auch, denn Jesus versammelte sich oft daselbst mit seinen Jüngern. Da nun Judas zu sich hatte genommen die Schar und der Hohenpriester und Pharisäerdiener, kommt ihr dahin mit Fackeln, Lampen und mit Waffen. Als nun Jesus wusste alles, was ihm begegnen sollte, ging hinaus und sprach zu ihnen:
Entzücket ihr?
Sie antworteten ihm:
Jesus, Jesus, Jesus von Nazareth.
Der ihn verriet, stund auch bei ihnen. Als nun Jesus zu ihnen sprach, ich bin's, wichen sie zurück und fielen zu Boden. Da fragte er sie abermal:
Wen suchet ihr?
Sie aber sprachen:
Jesus, Jesus, Jesus von Nazareth, Jesus von Nazareth, Jesus von Nazareth.
Our evangelist for this performance is the incomparable Timothy Bench, a tenor who's worked with the SDSO many times. His marriage of understanding of the text, expression of the text with his technical mastery is unparalleled in my view. At this moment, we come to the first chorale which would have been the moment when the congregation participates in the singing of the text. Chorales serve as a reflection upon the action that has just taken place. The text here is, O great love, O love beyond all measure, that is brought on this path of torment. I lived in the world with delight and joy, and you must suffer.
At this point in the narrative, Jesus has affirmed that he is in fact the one they've come to arrest. Simon Peter tries to intervene. He cuts off the ear of a servant, but Jesus rebukes him and heals the servant. He tells Peter to put his sword away. Shall I not drink of the cup which my Father has given to me? And then he submits to the soldiers who bind him and take him away.
We now have the first aria of the Passion. And an aria, like the chorales, is they're intended to reflect upon the action that's just taken place. This aria is for alto, and Bach illustrates the binding of Jesus by using two oboes that are sort of winding around each other, and then they come together in tandem, almost like a rope is being created. The text which the alto sings is, from the ropes of my sins to unbind me, my Savior is bound. Our mezzo-soprano here is Denise Gomez.
It's an amazing aria, and I can definitely hear the way that Bach weaves together those ropes with the oboes. There's other examples of Bach doing this that we'll point out later on, where he kind of acts out the action of the story. But now we're approaching another aria, one that's very different in tone, and it reflects, I think, the way that Bach uses the arias as a way of almost personal reflection on the action of what's taking place. So this one is surprisingly joyful, David.
Yes, this aria follows directly a recitative which talks about Peter following Jesus. And the text of the aria is, "I will follow you likewise with joyful steps." So Bach sets this text in a manner that sounds like a lilting dance, a kind of skipping quality. It's for soprano and two flutes, which also makes it very light, too. It gives it a kind of naivete. Here it's sung by an SDSO favorite, Hannah Celeste Liu.
Jumping ahead in the narrative a little bit, fast forwarding to a moment later in chapter 18 of John's Gospel, where Jesus, after having been arrested, is taken to the high priest's house, and in the courtyard outside, Simon Peter, one of his disciples, is waiting. And as he waits, the crowd outside asks him whether or not he is one of Jesus's followers, and he denies it three times, denies his Lord. And finally, after the third time, the cock crows. What's interesting about this passage is that this is where Bach actually reaches into Matthew's gospel and, as we see, pulls a particular passage, which David will tell us about in a little bit.
What's also interesting is the use of the chorus here. I often tell the chorus when we're rehearsing that you have to be schizophrenic because you're playing so many different roles. And in this particular scene, it's the role of the crowd of people in the courtyard who are asking, "Aren't you one of his disciples?" And you can almost hear in Bach's treatment of the chorus this sort of murmuring background kind of people gossiping.
Und Hannas sandte ihn gebunden zu dem hohen Priester Kaiphas. Simon Petrus stund und wärmete sie. Da sprachen sie zu ihm,
So let me just jump in and interrupt this narrative for a moment to point out a couple of unique things here. So normally recitative is syllabic in the sense that one note is assigned to every syllable in the text. To step out of that in order to make the text more expressive is something that Bach does particularly well. You'll hear at the very end of this next section on the text that Peter went out and wept bitterly. The word weinen is to weep, and you'll hear that this is a melisma, many notes on one syllable that's very expressive. You'll also actually hear the crowing of the rooster in the cello after the words that the evangelist sings, so bald krähte der Hahn, so and so the cock crowed.
Hello.
leugnete aber und sprach: Ich bin's nicht. Spricht es vor ein Priestersknecht einer, ein Gefreundeter, des dem Petrus das Ohr abgehauen hatte: Seist ich nicht im Garten bei ihm? Da verleugnete Petrus abermal. Und alsobald kräht er dir an. Da gedachte Petrus an die Worte Jesu und ging hinaus und war.
I think that weeping gives us another example of Bach using the music to emulate what's taking place there. And that is the passage from Matthew's gospel that Bach has intentionally brought into John's narrative to capture the idea of weeping, which isn't mentioned by John, but is by Matthew. So very intentionally, I think he wants to give us that emotion of sort of wringing out the tears in that way.
And then he extends this into the next aria, Ach, mein Sinn, which is for tenor, here sung by Heath Huberg. You can hear the anxiety. Again, an unsettled kind of accompaniment in the orchestra. It's with a dotted rhythm, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, which gets a sort of running quality to it. And then the tenor comes in and sings, Ach, mein Sinn, wo willst du endlich hin? My disposition, my senses, my being, where do you intend to go ultimately? How can I restore myself? So this sense of Peter, you know, running out from his denial with this big question of where do I go now? Just to reiterate, the function of these arias is a kind of personal application of the text, of what we just experienced. So, yes, it's Peter running out after his denial, but it's also us identifying with Peter's denial and then reflecting upon that ourselves.
And you see that illustrated in the final movement of part one, which is the chorale, which borrows from a German hymn that would have been familiar to the audience. And the verse that is sung actually starts with Peter and then personalizes that idea. So here's the text in translation. Peter, who did not recollect, denied his God, who yet after a serious glance wept bitterly. Jesus, look upon me also when I will not repent, when I have done evil, stir my conscience. So the worshiper identifies, recognizes in himself or herself the same weakness that Peter suffered from. And this part ends with a prayer to God that when we, like Peter, go astray, when we deny him, he will not deny us, and instead will stir our conscience. That's it for episode one, Arrest and Betrayal. We will leave you with this closing chorale, which ends part one of the St. John Passion. Next time, we will explore Bach's setting of the trial of Jesus in John chapters 18 and 19. David and I would like to thank our special guests, James Johnson and Marcel Switzer, who we will be hearing from in future episodes. For more information on Hearing the Music and for bonus content, visit us online at hearingthemusic.org.
Another big component of South Dakota culture is the outdoors. From spending time in a state park to casting a line to release a little stress, South Dakota outdoor lovers are challenged to find ways to connect with nature during the pandemic. So what are we doing to keep people safe in outdoor facilities? We had the South Dakota Secretary of Game, Fish, and Parks join us for an update.
Secretary Hepler, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks, Lori, and thanks to your listeners. And it's been a little while. I'm glad to be back on your program.
We're glad to have you here. Hope you're doing well. And one of the things I want to start with here, we've got some listener questions about what's allowed and what's not allowed. But you can just feel, when people talk about what they have lost or what they are waiting to get back to when things return to normal or what they didn't realize that was the most important thing to them, boy, South Dakota's outdoor places is really is pretty high up on the list. Are you feeling that longing from people too?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have one main statement we want to tell people: the outdoors remains open. We really need to get people outside and recreate. I can just tell you personally, from Carol and I, my wife and I are both in the state park here, local one, Farm Island yesterday, and the parking lot was full. But there was very few people we saw on the trails, and when we did, were young families, and you know, watching those kids were smiling, and the red-winged blackbirds were singing. It just kind of brings joy to your heart. And that's so important, because right now there's so much anxiety and almost like you feel like there's such a loss of control that you're alluding to. For mental health and just good of your family, we really do urge people to get outside and enjoy this great state we call South Dakota.
Right. Know what to do and what not to do. Know what's safe and know how to protect your family. Obey the CDC and the governor. And then put it all down and go take a step outside, because it's spring out there today, at least. I hear it might snow on Friday, but we've got a pretty nice day here. All right. So, Secretary Hepler, what's open and what's closed?
Well, basically everything is open. I mean, all our state parks are open. You know, we don't have people manning the stations, so we're letting people go without a new park pass. We just ask, you know, once we are back up and running again, come back in and buy the park pass. And so this is a good grace period. We don't have our comfort stations open, but we do have, like, all our potties are all open for people to use. Certainly all the trails are open, like, say, around here in Pier. We have our shooting range and our archery range. That's true in a lot of the places around the state. We don't have, like, say, some really popular places like getting into our outdoor campuses. Those are closed just for the benefit of the public and our staff. But you can go on Facebook, and both of those locations, as well as many of our parks, has Facebook activities. So when you are stuck inside, like Friday when it's snowing outside, you can't get outside, go to Facebook and look at those things. Fishing, though, I mean, prime time for fishing right now. You know, we're watching people catching fish in front of our house this weekend out in Hawaii. The walleye are picking up and the pike are picking up, so we urge people to get outside and go fishing. And spring turkey season, one of my favorite things of all time. All my stuff stacked neatly in my garage, or sort of neatly, waiting to go. But in every one of these things, this only works if people are smart. They think about it. They follow those CDC you know, listings that you talked about. Social distancing is so important, and people just got to be smart about it. They can't congregate. And, you know, we have some graphics we put on our website, you know, with the fishing pole and something. They're meant to be fun, but they send a serious message. Pay attention, people. And we want you to be positive. We want you to get outside, but these opportunities last because you're being good about it. So hopefully that helps, Lori.
Give me an idea of, you know, because there isn't, you know, a sanitation in a, you know, on a picnic table, or there's not going to be sanitation in the bathrooms, or, you know, how is that working? Because by encouraging people to go outside, you know, at some point they're going to have to use some of those facilities, especially restroom facilities. We don't want them, you know, not using those facilities to meet their needs, for example. But how do you encourage people to stay safe while doing that?
Well, we'll obviously clean, you know, certainly those toilets, we'll clean those all the time. So they'll be maintained that way. But as always, you know, wash your hands, you know, 20 seconds. This is going to sound like a broken record. But, you know, if you can, hopefully you can find that hand sanitizer, clean your hands and make sure it's dry good. I do that all the time. And then take some wipes along. If you're concerned about a picnic table, just clean it off with some wipes ahead of time. And that goes a long way. But just washing those hands, staying 5 or 6 feet away from there, you know, closest person, unless it's obviously your family. Those precautions should take care of most people's concerns.
For people who are listening to the advice and the request for no unnecessary domestic travel, some of these people have planned trips and need to cancel them. Most of these places you have to get to somehow, and if you're not supposed to be traveling, unpack that for me a little bit, because it feels like a little bit inconsistent.
Yeah, Lori, I'm glad you did bring that up. In fact, we had that conversation just 2 hours ago with our executive team, because we're going through this. You know, there's no real playbook you can go to figure out how to get through this. And so we're looking at it day by day and modifying where we think is important for public health and for our staff health. But this is those ones you balance that. You can stay holed up in your house, which I guess ideally they say is probably the best thing for this disease, but it certainly doesn't help your mental health. And just getting out and reducing that anxiety. So there's a balance, is that you still can get out, you can still recreate, but you just need to be smart about it. And so, like, say, for example, if you do have to go and use gas, those type of things, same type of thing, then just cleanse your hands and you get to using gas. And just, you know, I think it's a balance, and everybody's going to have to make that decision on their own. And it's one of those things, honestly, I wake up at 2 a.m. and I do think about, because the last thing that we want to do as GF&B is put some member of the public in a bad situation or our staff. But I think we found that balance, and I feel pretty comfortable where we're at right now, Lori.
And we've said on the show since this whole thing started that all these decisions have expiration dates. So people who are listening right now, because Secretary Hepler said this today, that doesn't mean, a week from now that the situation hasn't changed, or 3 days from now. So always check before you go. But give us an idea, Secretary Hepler, about, public safety and, you know, we talk about fishing and GF&P officers. What sort of, they need to get a little closer than, maybe we need to get when we're out, taking a hike. We can keep a great distance. But if somebody needs help, or if somebody is violating the law there, then those officers come into play. How are we prepared to protect them from what we don't know? Because many people who have this virus can be completely asymptomatic and not really know that they even have it.
Outstanding question. And we have spent quite a bit of time on that. We certainly give a lot of credit to our officers and our rangers, and then give them the discretion to make those kind of personal calls that they have to. We provided them with personal protection devices that they can use as far as a face shield, some of that they feel is necessary. But for the average, just to go check a license, we're saying you don't need to do that, and you just observe. But if they actually have to go help somebody, like with a boating accident, then, hopefully we have the stuff that they're prepared they can wear to reduce that. But there's always an element of risk, and I just want to, I want to thank our law enforcement. I want to thank all of our health providers. I mean, together they are really our front line, and God bless them all, because there's an element of risk. You just can't eliminate all of it. But they do that because they're dedicated and they think it's important. So I thank them.
All right. So the bottom line, things are still open. Please get your park pass later as a gesture of goodwill for the services that were provided, because those stations are not manned. Officers still on duty, but you really got to do those social distancing, those actions. It's just so important, Secretary Helpler. Just reiterate that for people before we let you go. If you're going to go out and do these things, you can't forget. Because here's one of the things that I find. You know, I go home and I do the things I'm supposed to do. I've washed my hands. I've cleaned, you know, the surfaces of my house. And I can turn off the news for a while and I could just unwind. And then I forget momentarily. And then I'm like, oh, that's right. Like, the world is not the same that it was yesterday. And then I have to switch back into that mode. You know, when you're out there on a hike, you're going to get in that space, which we want you to be in mentally, but you also have to stay vigilant.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, it's just, there isn't a new normal for this situation. You know, I know the governor asked us to unplug and think positive, and that's, you know, that's a mental health piece, but you need to be smart about it. So every, you know, media event we have or blast we send out, we talk about being smart about it. You know, people can go on our website and we have kind of the Q's and A's, what to do and what not to do. But every one of them is just, you know, be smart. We need to flatten this curve, and we will get through this. There's no question about that. We know that's going to happen. I can't emphasize that enough. Is, you know, those outdoors right now, those fishing capabilities and those docks are in the water because we want people to get outside. But, you know, please, please, follow those CDC rules.
For people who, you know, still have their income right now, who are lucky enough not to be employed and are grateful for that, some of them are supporting their local, you know, hair salons or their local restaurants as much as they can. What can people do, you know, to support their local game, fish, and parks? Can they buy those things online? You know, if they want to continue to make a commitment financially to buy licenses, how does that sort of work?
Well, they can, but the best thing they do is just get outside. That's the first thing we want people to do. But after that, Lori, thank you, is that, you know, they can go out, you can buy a fishing license online. You can go out and get your hunting license online. And like you said, when we get the parks back open, you can come back and you can certainly buy those park entrance fees that way. You can make reservations right now. Those reservation line for camping is still open on the park side. So there's a number of things they can do. You can also go on our site and, you know, you can donate money for Habitat. You know, there's a place there if you want to be able to do that. So all those things are great things to do. They support this outdoor legacy we call South Dakota. So anybody wants to do that, but the main thing is get outside, be safe.
Kelly Hepler, thank you so much for being here. Be well.
Lori, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Now, we will be hearing more updates from the Game, Fish, and Parks on In the Moment. So again, tune in at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain to hear the show live. But now, let's take a listen to part two of Hearing the Music.
Welcome to Hearing the Music, a show where we explore musical masterpieces and the meaning behind them. The music you're hearing is a chorale called Christus, der uns selig macht. In translation, that's Christ who makes us blessed. It's the opening of part two of Johann Sebastian Bach's Good Friday masterpiece, The St. John Passion. I'm Mark Bertrand. I'm a novelist and a Christian minister, the pastor of Grace Presbyterian Church in Sioux Falls. I'll be unpacking the ideas of the gospel narrative that Bach set to music. Our guide to the music is Delta David Geyer, music director of the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra. David conducted the St. John Passion in 2014 and has joined me here in the studio with the score open in front of him. Later, we'll hear from Dr. James Johnson, the SDSO's chorus master, on some of the nuances of Bach's composition. First, let's enjoy the rest of this chorale. Before I forget, this is episode 2, Trial and Tribulation.
That chorale begins part two of St. John Passion. It's a bit of a recapitulation of events we've just traversed in part one. The text says Jesus, who makes us blessed, committed no evil, yet he was seized as a thief. In the night, led forth and falsely accused, laughed at, scorned, despised, as the scripture says. And that, as the scripture says, leads into the next recitative, which continues the narrative of John's gospel.
I think it would be a good idea at this point to pause and just kind of recap the narrative, like how far we've come. So as we talked about in episode one, in the St. John Passion, Bach is using the text from John's gospel, the whole of chapter 18 and the whole of chapter 19. In episode one, we saw the arrest of Jesus, and we saw his trial before the high priest, specifically Peter's denial of Jesus. We fast-forwarded over some of the details there, so we didn't get into something that Bach actually does cover, which is Jesus before the high priest and the interaction that happens there. We left off last time in what would be John chapter 18, verse 27, with Peter's denial and the crowing of the cock. And now in part two, we pick up the story at that point. So we're picking up in John 18, 28. And in the section we're looking at in episode two, we're going to see a lot of back and forth dialogue. There's going to be a lot of dialogue between not only the evangelist narrating, but between Jesus and Pilate, who is the Roman authority who is in charge of the trial of Jesus. We'll also see Pilate arguing back and forth with the religious leaders who have brought Jesus on trial, and there'll be a kind of negotiation that takes place in which we'll see the virulent opposition against Jesus of those leaders. And we'll also see that Pilate is caught in the middle. He recognizes the innocence of Jesus, and yet at the same time is a weak leader who's concerned about the approval of the people and the approval of Caesar, and so he's easily manipulated. So John contrasts the strength of Christ as a spiritual king with the weakness and prevarication and the anger of all of those who are around him.
Indeed, and that authority of Jesus is something that Bach takes great care to set. If you look at the solo voices in the next recitative, you have three of them. You have the evangelist, of course, sung by Timothy Bench, but you have the very authoritative bass voice used for the character of Jesus, sung here by Craig Hart. And then you have Pilate, sung by baritone Stephen Conde, who will be singing some wonderful arias for us later on in the program. In this particular case, we have a rather famous question, a couple of them from Pilate, you know, so are you a king? And Jesus answered, and then Pilate asks, well, what is truth after all? But in the end, Pilate turns to Jesus' accusers and says, I find no guilt in this man, but you have a custom that we would release a prisoner to you at this time. Shall I release this king of the Jews? And then you have the chorus come in singing, not this one, but rather Barabbas. And after that, you have a very impassioned interjection from the evangelist, which says Barabbas or Barabbas, it was a murderer. And then it talks, he sings about Pilate taking Jesus out and scourging him. Another example of Bach using a melisma, or many notes on one syllable, for expression. So the word scourge, to flog or to beat, is used very expressively in this context.
Da sprach Pilatus zu ihm, so bist du denn noch ein König? Jesus antwortete, du sagst, ich bin ein König, ich bin dazu geboren und in die Welt kommen, dass ich die Wahrheit tue.
aus der Wahrheit ist, der höret meine Stimme.
Spricht Pilatus zu ihm,
was ist Wahrheit?
Und da er das gesaget, ging er wieder hinaus zu den Jüden und spricht zu ihnen.
Ich finde keine Schuld an ihm. Ihr habt aber eine Gewohnheit, dass ich euch eine Lust gebe. Wollt ihr nun, dass ich euch der Jüdenkönig losgebe?
Da schrien sie wieder allesamt und sprachen:
Mit diesem nicht, mit diesem Sohn sind verbunden, mit diesem Sohn verbunden, verbunden.
Barabbas aber war ein Mörder. Da nahm Pilatus Jesum und geißelte ihn.
So, Mark, there are times when Bach has been accused of anti-Semitism. Because, specifically because of this passion, because of the text of the Jews did this, the Jews said that, and they're in a very antagonistic role here. Why do we have this issue, particularly with this piece, do you think?
That's a good question. When you're reading the text, you'll see John's Gospel will refer to the Jews did this or the Jews did that. And he uses that term as a shorthand for the religious leaders, the high priest and his circle who are involved. And it's important to remember that that's what he's referring to, because, of course, Jesus himself is Jewish, Simon Peter is Jewish, everyone in the story is Jewish, except for Pilate, who points this out when he turns to Jesus and says, "Am I a Jew? You know, I shouldn't know anything about your internal squabbles." So it is a very Jewish story that's being told. John's Gospel was probably written a little bit later on in the history, where Christianity, which began as a movement within Judaism, within the synagogues, there had been a break at that point. And he's writing to an audience that is not steeped in that culture any longer. So he's using that term as a shorthand. I don't think John, the evangelist, intends an anti-Semitic statement. He is himself Jewish, and it's possible that people can misconstrue a text and use it in ways it's not intended for, but I think it's also the case that Bach does not intend to express that kind of a sentiment.
Quite the opposite, right? I mean, he's really trying to remain true to the gospel narrative as is presented in the book of John.
That's right.
And the fact that John was writing for a Hellenistic culture who had no point of reference back to Jewish culture would have explains that particular language, which you don't find in the other gospels, correct?
That's right. That's right. So in John's gospel, because the story is thematically arranged, you do see certain differences from the other gospels. And one of the things you see is a kind of dualism that's expressed. So Jesus, who is pure and is holy, is confronted by various examples of weakness and duplicity and betrayal throughout this passage. And the contrast is meant to illustrate the purity of Christ.
So at this point, we have a beautifully contemplative aria sung by Stephen Condy. Betrachte meine Seele, contemplate my soul with anxious pleasure. The highest good in Jesus' suffering, that how for you out of the thorns that pierce him, the tiny keys of heaven bloom. So at the beginning of his suffering, right after the scourging that we've just heard in the previous recitative, we're asked to sort of prepare ourselves for what's about to take place, in the sense that we need to to contextualize this within the greater good that's about to come out of this ordeal. Our chorus master, James Johnson, points out that this aria falls directly in the center of the St. John Passion, which is important for Bach, the placement of different pieces. But he also points us to specific instruments that are used.
And then to do it with two of the instruments that Bach himself spent a fair amount of time playing, the lute and the viol d'amore. And it is such a personal reaction to this sacrifice, to this ultimate perfect sacrifice, to say, look, my soul, you have to, as a person, consider this agony and the rapture and the whole pain that was part of this.
Before we continue with the gospel narrative, in our conversation with James Johnson earlier, we talked about the different roles that the chorus plays. And you'll notice throughout the upcoming recitative that the chorus pops in a lot of different contexts. So, James, give us some insight.
The chorus itself, I think, is very, very much a mirror for Bach of his idea through Luther of what the human condition is, that we are both sinner and saint, and then also in the Passion itself that we're the perpetrators of it, but we are also the penitents who realize what has happened and that we are responsible in it.
Musically, we left off with Jesus being flogged and followed by a beautifully contemplative aria on Christ's suffering. And now we re-enter the gospel narrative where Jesus is being crowned.
Yeah, and there's an irony to this because the question throughout these chapters has been whether Jesus is a king and what kind of king he is. And we're seeing here he is going to be crowned, albeit with a crown of thorns. They will sing a song hailing him as king, although it is a song of mockery. So, ironically, they are giving him the worship that is his due, the coronation that is his due. But as John is pointing out, his kingdom is not like earthly kingdoms, and his coronation is not like earthly coronations. Here, he has come to suffer death on the cross, but he's done it for our salvation. He's done it to achieve that future glory.
Indeed. So in this upcoming narrative, what strikes me is the use of the chorus again. And when he's saying, you know, hail King of the Jews is what they're saying. But, and I would have thought that it would have been like an angry kind of mocking, but the way Bach sets it, it's almost dismissive. It's just very light and like, you know, just mocking.
Yeah, it is. I think it captures very well the spirit of these men. They don't take it seriously. They're having fun with it, ironically, as they're inflicting this torture.
Und die Kriegsknechte flochten eine Krone von Dornen und setzten sie auf sein Haupt. Und legten ihm ein Purpurkleid an und sprachen.
Sei, 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 sei.
to interject a moment in the middle of this narrative, just to point out some of the unique qualities of the recitative here, where Pilate is basically once again saying, "I see no problem with this man," but then he throws a crown of thorns on him and a purple robe and says, "Behold the man." With that in mind, let's listen to the first of two Crucify Him sections. You can hear the tension in the chorus as they sing the word kreuzige, which means crucify. You'll hear dissonances grinding between soprano and alto and then tenor and bass, and they layer on top of each other in a kind of mass hysteria.
Und gaben ihm Backenstreiche. Da ging Pilatus wieder hinaus und sprach zu ihnen:
Sehet, ich führe ihn heraus zu euch, dass ich erkennet, dass ich keine Schuld an ihm finde.
Also ging Jesus heraus und trug eine Dornenkrone und Purpurkleid. Und er sprach zu ihnen:
Sehet, welch ein Mensch!
Da ihm die Hohenpriester und die Diener sahen, schrien sie und sprachen:
Jumping ahead here to a pivotal moment of decision for Pilate. Pilate knows that Jesus is not worthy of death, but he can't convince the crowd of that. And they finally find the way to get him to go along with what they want. They tell him, if you let this man go, then you are no friend of Caesar's, for whoever makes himself a king is against Caesar. And that does the trick. Pilate decides to give them what they want, to crucify Jesus. But interestingly, once he's made that capitulation, he starts to mock them. So he presents Jesus to them as their king. He says, "Behold, this is your king." And when they reject that idea, he emphasizes it further. "You don't want me to crucify your king, do you?" That sort of thing. And what that has the effect of doing is getting the people riled up so that they eventually make the damning declaration, "We have no king but Caesar."
Right, so that's what you'll hear in the rest of this narrative here, is you'll hear Pilate say, "So here's your king," and them reacting, and it becomes more dismissive as it goes. The chorus sings, "Away, away with him, veg, veg mit dem." And over that is integrated the crucify him again, you know, building, you know, kreuzige ihn. Then you'll hear Pilate say again, "Shall I crucify your king?" And then, surprisingly, again, to me, the chorus representing the crowd sings, "We have no king but Caesar." But again, it's dismissive. It's almost not serious. It's like, just be done with it.
Seht, das ist euer König.
Sie schreien aber...
Thank you.
ich euren König kreuzigen.
Die hohen Priester antworteten:
Wir haben keinen König.
After that very dismissive chorus proclaiming that we have no king but Caesar, Pilate proclaims that Jesus should be crucified. You'll notice in the following recitative that the evangelist sings very expressively, particularly on the word gekreuziget, crucified, that he should be crucified. This recitative ends by saying that he was taken to the place called Golgotha. It sets up the next aria beautifully. Now comes a very pivotal aria here, sung again by Stephen Condy. Eilt ihr angefochten Seelen, hurry, you troubled, you besieged souls. And you'll hear the rushing of the strings, upward rushing in scales. Then you'll hear the chorus come in, Wohin, 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 where to? Where are we rushing to? And at the very end, the soloist drops in to Golgotha, like run, run, run to Golgotha. And then he answers, you know, why? The why? Fly, fly to the cross's hilltop, because your welfare blooms there.
That's an amazing line to me, because a lot of times you might imagine that there's this hurry, this rush to come to like the scene of an accident or a catastrophe or something. But the energy that you hear in this piece is urging people to gather together, to coalesce on the cross, the place of their salvation. It's as if by the act of Christ's death, the cross has become the tree of life. This is the place to seek shelter and salvation. It's time to bring this episode to a close. Let's end with some music that may sound familiar, even if the lyrics you associate with it are different. This is the chorale in Meines Herzengründe. In the bottom of my heart, your name and cross alone sparkles.
Thanks for joining us for Episode 2, Trial and Tribulation. Next time, through Bach's music, we will contemplate the crucifixion of Jesus. David and I would like to thank our special guest this week, Dr. James Johnson, for sharing his insight with us. You can hear our entire interview by visiting us online at hearingthemusic.org.
Now, we will be hearing parts 3 and 4, hopefully next week. We're going to end the program today by hearing Eliza Blue's Postcards from the Prairie. Enjoy.
As a child, I was prone to anxiety. In first grade, during a unit on fire safety, my teacher told us we should go home and plan emergency escape routes with our families. I ran home that day and told my parents, who offered a few thoughts on the matter, and then moved on to other things. But for weeks afterward, I lay in bed at night imagining my role in the escape. How I would run from my room to my brother's bed, fling open the window, push out the screen, then help him through it before jumping after him into the darkness. For better or for worse, this is my personality type, and I've come to accept that being in a state of high alert is how I naturally operate. It has its assets. Rarely one to stray from the prescribed path for fear of calamity, during high school I made lots of good, responsible choices, which led to acceptance at an excellent college. As a result, when I graduated, I had plenty of job prospects. But, of course, I was also a wreck, and exhausted, and in desperate need of a vacation from myself. During the intervening decades, I have found healthier ways to handle my penchant for anxious thoughts, or catastrophizing as I now describe it. Spending time outside, getting plenty of physical activity, having routines that draw me out of the spiral of worry are all helpful, and no doubt the reason ranch life suits me so well. I've often wished that all those who suffer from anxiety or depression had the opportunity to live rurally. I don't know if it would help everyone, but I know it has helped me. Perhaps the best antidote for my fears, however, has simply been getting older. I've learned life does not present itself as endless progress, but endless possibility. There is always more to discover. Every crossroad contains a gift, destined to unfurl in its own time. And I've learned not to put too much stock in my very active imagination when it comes to risk assessment. It's a great attribute for my writing practice, not as helpful for making decisions. Well, 2 weeks ago, a phone call from a dear friend who was supposed to come stay with us from Italy left us reeling. His report of what was happening in his country, as well as an admonishment to stay home, was terrifying. For the first time in a long time, I felt my senses ramping up to high alert. And each day since, as reports of fresh recommendations clamor ceaselessly, has felt like a mini marathon of stress escalation. The news continues to be bleak. For our part, here on the ranch, social distancing during calving and lambing season is effortless. Stemming the tide of worry over far-flung friends and family is not easy. So, I turn again to what has worked in the past. I listen for the meadowlark's shrilled greeting. I look to the pasture, ripe to awaken from the first blush of green splendor. I watch while newborn calves, wet as dew, lift themselves on wobbling legs to catch sips of their mother's sweet milk. I tell myself to keep moving, to chase the children, to catch them and cradle them, then release them to run, once again laughing across the yard. To discover again and again how little control we humans actually have of outcomes, but how much control we have over cultivating wellsprings of joy, well, that is the work of a lifetime. The work does not cease, but flows onward, catching us in its current, offering us up as guardians of our own sense of wonder, until, even in the deepest darkness, we discover the firmament of stars twinkling high above our heads, a blessing and a benediction.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.